Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. On today's episode, a good old-fashioned ghost story. Now, before you shake your head and say, yeah, just another supernatural hoax, this isn't just one person who experienced some unusual activity. Multiple credible witnesses filed police reports saying it really did happen. With us today is Jamie Pettit, assistant archivist at the Bridgeport History Center. It was in her city of Bridgeport where the so-called Lindley Street poltergeist literally captivated the city's attention during the fall of 1974. She's going to be along in just a moment with the hair-raising details. This week's trivia question: 49 people nearly drowned in an absolutely unbelievable incident off the coast of Fairfield back in 1921. What was that incident? Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. When people need the best quality health care, there's a reason they turn to Yale New Haven Health. In 1826, Yale New Haven Hospital became Connecticut's very first hospital. They were the first hospital in the U.S. to use chemotherapy. Yale New Haven was the first to introduce insulin pumps for diabetic patients. And they introduced the world's first intensive care unit for newborns. For more information about Yale New Haven Health, visit YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. Well, today's going to get a little wild. This is a ghost story with some pretty unbelievable parts to it. In fact, it's more than a little wild. It's downright unbelievable. Incredible happenings said to involve a house in Bridgeport and its three inhabitants. Now, you're going to hear all the details in a moment. I don't want to spoil it here, but what I do want to convey is that there are many credible people who signed witness statements to police that the supernatural activities inside this house really did happen. On a quick sidebar note, back in my journalism days, I covered one of the more sensational stories in this genre, the so-called Devil Made Me Do It murder case. It was back in 1981, there was a stabbing in Brookfield, Connecticut, first murder in that town's history, and the defense tried to enter a plea in court of not guilty by reason of demonic possession. Well, the judge didn't allow it, otherwise it would have been a very interesting case. Now, you may have seen the documentary about this case on Netflix. I am in it. It's called The Devil on Trial, and you can watch it, so long, of course, as you have Netflix. Now, the point of me sharing all this is I've heard my share of bizarre claims about the supernatural over the years, and it's almost always the case that there's no third-party verification by a credible source of what was supposedly seen and heard. The story of the Lindley Street poltergeist, as you're about to hear, though, is quite a bit different, even though it was officially labeled a hoax by the head of the police department. However, as you're also about to hear, that declaration didn't necessarily sit well with a number of people who swear to this day that it was not a hoax, including some of the police chief's own officers. Well, the full story of the Lindley Street poltergeist is contained in a book, The World's Most Haunted House. It was written by William Hall, a researcher who used to be associated with the Bridgeport History Center. Now, Hall compiled all the facts, all the claims, the witness testimony, all of this so we could have a record of the goings-on back in the 70s on Lindley Street in Bridgeport. At the center of the controversy is a young adopted girl named Marcia Leah Gooden. It seems that soon after her adoption was approved and she joined the Gooden family back in the late 60s, well, things were never quite the same after that. Here to tell us this story is Jamie Pettit. Now, Jamie's the assistant archivist at the Bridgeport History Center, the same facility where Hall, the book's author, worked from. Now, it's important to note that most of what you're about to hear from Jamie comes from information contained in Hall's book, so it doesn't necessarily reflect her own personal views about this case. Let's start off talking about what we know. So there was Gerard and Laura Gooden. They were a Bridgeport couple. They bought this house in 1960. Nothing was wrong with the house initially. They unfortunately had a six-year-old son who died of cerebral palsy in 1967. And the year later, they adopt Marcia, who is this full-blooded Seneca Native American from Canada. She comes into the family in 1968 at the age of four, and by the time she's 10 in 1974, literally all hell is breaking loose in terms of paranormal activity. As I understand the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, some odd things started to happen right about then in 1968, but they got progressively worse through 1974. Is that how you read the record?
Yeah, so that is basically the long and short of it. Marcia Lydia Gooden, she was originally from Ontario, Canada, and was adopted by the Goodens. Jerry and Laura had lived in Bridgeport for quite some time. Jerry was a factory worker for Harvey Hubble. They were lifelong Catholics. Jerry had even been an altar boy in his youth. They had no issues with the house prior to the adoption of Marcia. It seems that the activity really started shortly after she was adopted in 1968, reportedly. It was described by Jerry that the house was being stoned, as though somebody was throwing rocks against the walls. Constant tapping, but no significant activity.
Now, this gets progressively worse. So Marcia is four when she's adopted. When the peak activity occurs in 1974, she's now 10 years old. Tell me what we know about her years in school. I understand, you know, she was not befriended by a lot of kids. She got bullied a little bit and even beat up once. Is that true?
Yeah, it is reported that she was very badly mistreated by her peers in the Bridgeport school system.
Is there any speculation in the Hall book that, you know, maybe this led to her trying to start some pranks, or is that completely out of left field?
I do know that there was a little bit of a fraught relationship between her and her mother, according to Hall. Laura was a bit of a helicopter parent. Marcia seems to have had a little bit of resentment for her because of that. Very much did not let Marcia out of her sight. This could be because Laura had some social issues. She grew up in an environment where she didn't really have a lot of peers of her own age. Also, after losing a child, I imagine you are very, very protective and afraid of losing your next one.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. I couldn't imagine what she must have been going through emotionally with all that. And then on top of all this, odd things start happening. Now, it did sort of build up gradually, didn't it? It wasn't just one day all of a sudden Armageddon broke out. It was kind of gradual, wasn't it?
Yes, that's what the Goodens claim, is that this was sort of activity that was gradually on and off. It really only came to a head, it seems, on Saturday, November 22nd of 1974. That's when the real violent activity reportedly started. According to the Goodens, the trouble began when Jerry returned home from his shift at a local factory. Family had just had dinner. They had gathered in their living room to watch TV. And they start hearing a series of noises behind the master bedroom door. Hall describes it in his book as unexpected and indescribable. The three of them decide to investigate. This is led, of course, by Jerry to find the bedroom's window shade has been completely rolled up and the curtains are knocked to the floor. Apparently, Jerry and Laura attempted to replace the rod and curtains, but just after they did that, an unseen force yanked them off once more and threw them to the floor. The shade also apparently snapped up. The family was, of course, pretty shaken. So they returned to the living room and tried to ignore what had just happened and watch their program. But apparently the knocking started up once more. It was very, very violent. I believe it was described as a lot of fists pounding on the walls that were getting louder and louder. I believe that finally ceased at 3 a.m. at night.
Wow. Now, I read somewhere, like you say, this was 1974, I understand that there was at least enough going on, that there was enough concern that they actually called the police a couple of years before that, 1972, and got the police involved. Did you see that anywhere in the record?
Yes, they did previously make a call to police in 1972 over the noises.
And what did the police do? Do we know? Did they come in and investigate? They didn't find anything, right?
So, yes, they did call the police at that time over the sounds. I believe they thought that it was a neighbor at the time that was pranking them. They actually had a neighbor who was a part of the Bridgeport Police Department. He could not find a satisfactory explanation. I don't believe any of the police or first responders that came to that scene ever found a satisfactory explanation, but it seems that the activity died down after that for a while.
Now, that was 1972. Then in 1974, as things start to ramp up, is this when they start seeing things like the refrigerators levitate and the furniture move around? Is that when that all started in 1974?
That actually happened the day after the curtain incident. Apparently, the day started off as normal. They actually returned from a day out together doing groceries. While carrying groceries in, Jerry noticed that Phoebe and Laura's bedroom was on the bed and wires were yanked out of their sockets. When he returned to the kitchen, he was greeted with a very disturbing sight, which were plates rising out of the sink and hurling themselves across the kitchen into the wall. He and Laura had no idea what to do. And at this point, he alleges while he's bending it down to pick up the debris from the plates, as the activity kind of simmered down at that point, five knives flew out of the knife block and flew across the kitchen at him. He was apparently able to duck before any of them actually did any serious harm to him. After that, the table rose up and apparently flipped over. All the objects that were on it were flung into the air. So it was a really big mess at this point, according to the Goodens. And that is actually when the refrigerator, this is a 300-pound 1970s refrigerator, lifted 6 inches off the ground and turned towards them before setting back to the ground. I believe Hall describes it as though the refrigerator wanted to show them that it did this. You know, like, look at me.
What I find also amazing about this particular story is if it was just Jerry Gooden and his wife and his daughter saying these things happened, you know, you could dismiss this as, you know, somebody's having a fantasy or, you know, some sort of experience. But there were a number of people who saw and heard very similar things. Is that correct?
Yes, there were quite a few people involved in this, actually. It sort of was a situation that blew up as more and more people got involved the next day, November 24th, 1974. That morning, a silver crucifix and portrait go flying off the walls with nails attached to them. This is around 8:30 a.m. in the morning. Then a large wooden bureau fell in Marcia's room. The crucifix in there was thrown down. I think the breaking point for them that really drove them into a panic was they reported that reclining chairs that were in the living room started moving and a doorbell sound started coming from the TV. They ran out and apparently called their neighbor Janet Hallsworth for help. Her father was a member of the police. So he was apparently the first officer on the scene, John Hallsworth. He went in and claimed to see chairs and a TV moving. He also claimed that he was bumped by the refrigerator while he was investigating. So this situation starts to spiral out of control at this point because two other officers receive a call of a disturbance. And so they start witnessing this activity as well. They're seeing the TV swinging and moving on its own, they report, and then two more police officers arrive on the scene. And it's reported by the four of them that they saw the refrigerator float. They apparently extensively checked the cause of this activity. They couldn't find anything in the basement or any sort of wires or strings that might have been pulling this large object around. Apparently, during this time, another cross started swinging and ripped itself out of the wall and actually hit one of them in the chest. And this guy apparently says, "That's it, I'm out of here," and he left. Paul says that he rushed out of there, locked his car doors, and left.
Wow. That's amazing. I heard somewhere that there were as many as maybe 75 people who gave statements. Where did all these people come from?
So after the police are experiencing this activity, they actually called up the fire department for assistance. A total of 10 firemen and 3 units arrive on the scene. The assistant chief sees the TV fall over upon entry. Again, they can't find anything. They are checking the basement. They are checking for any sort of cause of this. They actually might have suspected, according to Hall, that there was construction going on at St. Vincent's Hospital, which is very close to where this house is. That might have been the cause of the disturbances, but they cannot find anything. They actually are the ones who bring in the first priest on the scene. This is Father Edward Doyle, who is the chaplain of the fire department.
Now, does Chaplain Doyle see anything himself?
Chaplain Doyle comes in and he witnesses that the family is very distressed. As reported in the newspapers and in Hall's book, he did not witness personally any of the events or activity himself. He did, however, bless the house, tried to provide what comfort he could to the family. There was no formal procedure, to my knowledge, of exorcism by the Diocese of Bridgeport. They never authorized that. There were 2 priests and a seminarian who came on the scene. The first was, of course, Father Doyle. The other 2 were Father William Charbonneau, who was actually a peer of Ed Warren, who Ed Warren actually asked to tag along. They also brought along Paul Enno, who was a seminarian at the time, who Ed instructed to stay with Marcia and just note if any activity was happening around her. Both Charbonneau and Paul Enno did say that they personally witnessed activity. Is quoted in the Bridgeport Post as saying, "This is no hoax. I saw this TV fall over."
Interesting. Now, I mean, we all know Ed and Lorraine Warren, the late, great Ed and Lorraine Warren, that some people who are skeptics of them say that these types of, you know, sightings tend to occur when they're involved and they don't occur when they're not involved. Yet this is not entirely the case here, is it? There were sightings by police and firemen who preceded the Warrens' involvement.
There were quite a few witnesses before the Warrens got involved. The Warrens caught wind of this because a neighbor of the Goodens had attended one of their lectures and has some connections with them, called them up and said, "Hey, I think we got a haunting over here." So they drove over with Father Bill and Paul Inno and started to investigate. They claimed to have witnessed some activity. Lorraine Warren claimed that a second-degree burn had actually formed on her hand during their investigation. I believe she picked up on some very negative energy. They actually also heard, apparently, some strange noises that were coming in the direction of the cat.
I was going to ask you about the cat because there is some talk that the cat actually said or sang or something jingle bells and also uttered the words bye-bye very clearly. Tell me about that.
Jerry Gooden reported he had never actually seen, the cat's name is Sam, he had never actually seen Sam talk, like move his lips or anything. However, he had heard voices from the direction of where the cat was, especially when the cat went down to the basement. So he had heard things like jingle bells, bye-bye, in a sort of sailor's voice, he described it as. When the cat was down in the basement, he would also yell things like, "Let me out, you dirty Greek, you dirty Frenchman." Of course, Jerry never actually saw the cat speak, so it was just from the general direction. Father Bill and the Warrens also apparently reported that they did hear voices coming from the direction of the cat, but we don't have any actual eyewitness testimony that the cat itself spoke.
I guess I'm actually pretty happy to hear that, because that would have added an incredible wrinkle to this. Let me go back to something here that really sort of added to this entire case, which was at some point the story leaked to the Bridgeport paper, and this caused great crowds to gather outside the house almost on a nightly basis. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, yeah, there was quite a few people that showed up at this house. You'd think that this case was supposed to be hush hush or something like that, but really the police and fire department had no idea what was going on. All of this happened very fast. The span of which the first policeman got there and the span of which the Warrens arrived on the scene was very, very short. This was the same day. And so the media frenzy happened at breakneck speed. You had reporters coming in at 4 p.m. on the day that the police and fire department first arrived. You have priests that are coming into the house, and this is about a year after The Exorcist release, which I imagine increased the fanfare of this. So Ed Warren himself was not helping the situation. He comes onto the scene, and according to the Goodens, he starts calling up press from like far and wide, trying to get this story spread to more and more places. This really just spirals into a media frenzy. So you have people that are like camping out. William Hall writes that there were actually people who were becoming sort of vendors. They were selling drinks and snacks to these crowds that were just piling up at the fences, trying to see like moving furniture. These crowds, even when it was declared a hoax by Walsh, they did not go away. They went all the way into the Thanksgiving weekend. There was actually, I don't know if you know about this, there was an arson attempt at that house on the night of Thanksgiving. Three men tried to burn the house down to cleanse it of evil spirits.
Wow. Now, let's spend a second on Joe Walsh. So he's the police commissioner or chief. I forget what his title was, but he was the head honcho in the police department. And he comes out and declares this whole thing a hoax. You should tell the story. What did one of the police officers witness Marcia doing?
So, one of the police officers that was there in the evening saw Marcia knock over a TV with her foot, and she did not know he noticed until he gave her sort of a knowing look. And that's when the police who were on duty started to, question her about it. She did admit, yes, I did this stuff. It's kind of sad because after she does that, she goes to her room and cries. Her parents are, understandably upset. But the police, with this information, report back to Walsh, and Walsh is very relieved that he's got an answer to this and that they can actually start dissipating the crowds. And Joe Walsh was not a believer in any sense. He was saying things like, there are no ghosts in Bridgeport. And he actually threatens the Warrens at this time. He says, if you come back to Bridgeport, I will arrest you. Of course, that's an empty threat. He can't actually do that. This was actually the time where the Goodens decide to cut ties with the Warrens, and this is because Marcia mentions to Laura that she thinks that Lorraine burned her hand on purpose. And of course, they didn't appreciate that Ed was trying to sort of spread the story. They kind of saw that as very much moves of like press hounds, attention hounds. So they completely cut ties with the Warrens, Father Bill, Paul Eno, and they essentially become social pariahs after that. The activity they report still happened after that, but the police were instructed not to take any of the calls that came from the Goodens about the paranormal activity seriously after that.
So when you think about Joe Walsh coming out and making a blanket statement that this whole thing is a hoax, when his own police officers and firefighters and others have reported seeing this phenomena happen, what did he say? Did he have his officers retract their earlier testimony, or how did he handle that?
He very much implied that they were victims to the power of suggestion. I believe one of the police chiefs actually demonstrated what they believe would have happened. He's talking to the press and he has a chair, and he tips the chair over, and of course the press's attention are all on him. So that was sort of the example that he gave about how all of these police officers could have been fooled.
But didn't one of the police officers say that the refrigerator bumped into them?
Yes, they did. And a lot of the officers publicly defended their own testimonies and the family. You have actually the first officer on the scene, Officer Joe Tomek, and he is quoted in Hall's book as saying, there has to be a logical explanation for the things I saw, but whatever it is, I don't have the explanation. I doubt the Goodens could have caused these things to move. It was in my personal observation that they typically weren't even near things when they moved.
Wow. It makes you wonder. I mean, with all these cases that you hear about, it's usually somebody who you can maybe write off, but there's just too many people who saw and heard things.
I think it's a very odd situation, whatever way you look at it. There's so many different moving parts to this story. It becomes very odd and confusing about what happens. I think it's really just a very open case you have to decide for yourself on with all the facts.
Finally, Marcia and the Goodens, when they sort of moved on in life, eventually things stopped. They sold the house. And Marcia, I read somewhere, they believe, moved to, I think it was Ohio, someplace in the Midwest, and died under a different name. Do you have any information on that?
It's actually a bit of a sadder story. So the Goodens did put their house up for sale on January 10th of 1975. However, nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted a house that was supposedly haunted. So it never did sell in their lifetimes. Jerry endured a lot of ridicule at work. At some point, Marcia, according to Hall, cut ties with the Goodens altogether. It was apparently reported that she was working in Bridgeport when she was 19. After that, what happened to her, the trail sort of goes cold. Hall did hire a private investigator to track Marcia, but he found no mention of her in any records after the 70s. What he believes is that she most likely returned to Canada to find her birth parents. So Hall's book was published in 2014, and according to him, he actually received confirmation from a cousin of the family that Marcia was, in fact, alive and well at that time. If she's still alive as of 2023, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that she doesn't want to be found, and understandably, I doubt she'll want to come forward with her side of the story.
Hall says there were more than 100 witnesses who said they saw or heard the supernatural happenings at the house. Now, as Jamie says, it's really up to each of you to decide for yourself whether you believe it or not. That wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Yes, the house on Lindley Street is still standing, and you can drive by it, as I did, but please don't bother the residents inside. They've not encountered any of the same issues that the Goodens did back in the 70s, and frankly, they'd like to keep it that way. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Jamie Pettit, Assistant Archivist at the Bridgeport History Center. The answer to this week's trivia question... Well, the question was, 49 people nearly drowned in Long Island Sound in an absolutely unbelievable incident off the coast of Fairfield back in 1921. What was that incident? The answer is, a submarine sank. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we'll tell you about the S-48, the U.S. Navy sub that was on its maiden voyage. But it turns out when it sank, nobody knew, due to reasons we'll have to tell you about next time. The 49 crew members were trapped with no way out. And let me tell you, it's a spellbinding story that'll have you riveted to your seat. It's as gripping a story as they come. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.